You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And Senator Bernie Sanders, this is going to be our Brunch with Bernie hour. However, Bernie got called away for a moment. He is going to be with us at the bottom of the hour, about 25 minutes. He'll be joining us from the Senate studios. So all shall be good. But in the meantime, I wanted to share with you one of the things. You know, there's of course, all the stuff that's the obvious stuff in the news. The things you see in the newscasts, but there's a subset to the news, and that is the assumptions that are being laid on the American people. And there is one in particular that I found absolutely shocking. Just consider this. One of the main things that Franklin Roosevelt brought with the New Deal, and that Teddy Roosevelt talked about in his Square Deal speech, and we've played that audio before that Thomas Edison personally recorded in 1913 of Teddy Roosevelt saying, "We stand for a square deal. Wages are substandard when they can't meet normal living conditions." And one of the things that Teddy Roosevelt said in that speech was, at the very end, he said, "And provide for a decent retirement." Now, Franklin Roosevelt, the same thing. Social Security was not just to lift people out of poverty. Keep in mind, in the 1930s, when Social Security was passed, half of all people over the age of 65 were living in poverty. Now it's 10% as a result of Social Security. But it wasn't just an anti-poverty program. It was also, there was this idea that we had that if somebody works for 40 years or 45 years, from age 20 to age 65, that's 45 years. If somebody works 45 years, they ought to be able to take a few years off before they die. They ought to have this thing called retirement. They ought to have, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years where they can just kind of kick back and be grandparents or be wise elders. This, you know, in most tribal societies, there is this notion of the wise elder in the society. Now, here is Rick Santorum. This is clip number 5, Chris. Rick Santorum comes out and basically says, first of all, life expectancies have expanded since the 30s, in large part since the 40s, actually. They always talk about the 30s. Penicillin was rolled out in the 40s, and that extended life expectancies for elderly people. But most of the increase in life expectancy that we've seen in the United States is that two centuries ago, you know, 1 in 3, 1 in 5 children, I don't remember the number, but it was a substantial, children died before the age of 5. Now virtually all children who are born survive to the age of 5. I mean, we have a high infant mortality rate. I think it's 1 in 1,000, or maybe it's 2 or 3 in 1,000. It's not one of the very best in the world. A lot of the European countries do better than us. But basically, by eliminating infant mortality, mostly by having sanitary conditions in operating rooms, by better maternal care, by, you know, by providing health care to women who are pregnant, by eliminating those things, what we have done is the net aggregate lifespan has increased. But it doesn't mean that people are, the average working person is living that much longer, maybe a year, 2 years, something like that, you know, fancy medicines, whatnot. But basically, what Rick Santorum is saying here, and I want you to listen very carefully to this clip, to what he's not saying. This is the Republican strategy, is to shift the frame, right? The frame used to be that everybody is entitled to a decent retirement. Therefore, they should have a pension at work. And 2/3 of Americans had a pension when Ronald Reagan came into office. About 1/3 of Americans were unionized, and about 1/3 of Americans had the equivalent of a union job because unions set the floor. That there should be a retirement of some kind, there should be a pension associated with that, and of course all Americans had the pension or the retirement or whatever you want to call it, the supplement, the insurance that is Social Security. Here's Rick Santorum.
Social Security was established for people who were too old to work, and therefore they needed the support of the federal government. I don't know of anyone who's 62 years old who sees himself as elderly. Now, back in 1936, he probably did. Why? Because life expectancy in 1936 was 61. It's now 80. We can look at retirement ages for, and again, you'll still be able to retire at 62 or take Social Security. You just get a slightly smaller benefit. Why? Because we can't afford the benefit structure we have because people are living too long.
Right. So he semi-walks back at the beginning because he's talking to a senior group. And but if you look at the programs that these guys are putting forward, it's like, you know, let's do like the dictator Pinochet did in 1981 in Chile and privatize Social Security. Well, you know, the problem with that is that Social Security, when it got privatized in Chile, the average overhead that the banksters were charging was from 14% to 22%, depending on the plan you chose. Social Security's overhead is 3%, and Social Security actually makes money with its investments by investing them in Treasury bills, which pay interest. During times of high inflation, Social Security makes a lot of money. We're not in one of those times right now. But I find this just fascinating that this new frame is going to be, this is basically, again, the first, just play the first 10 seconds of Rick Santorum here one more time.
Social Security was established for people who were too old to work, and therefore they needed the support of the federal government.
Okay, there you go, too old to work. So it wasn't, you know, if you put in your 30 years or your 35 years or your 40 years or your 45 years, you're entitled to retirement. It's that you're too old to work. Now, I'll give you, there are a lot of people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s who are still participating in the workforce, and many of them very productively. But that doesn't mean that people shouldn't have the right to say, you know, I'm going to take a sabbatical. I'm going to take a retirement. I just find it amazing. So I wanted to point that out, that this, you know, watch this thing coming down the road. From the privatization of Medicare by the Republicans to the privatization of Social Security. By the way, in 81 in Chile, and the Republicans are still talking about how wonderful this is. In fact, Herman Cain in the Republican debates last week said, I like the Chilean system. Well, this is where they privatized their Social Security system in 1981. President Michelle Bachelet, I think is how she pronounces her name, in 2008 put back into place a government program for Social Security in Chile. Because there were some years where people were getting negative returns. In fact, there was one negative return of 6.8% a couple of years ago because the market went in the tank. And, you know, with a 20% management fee and the fund is not making any money, you're screwed. So anyway, I thought that is in my mind one of the stories behind the stories. And think about it, you know, if you're 20 years old, if you're 30 years old, if you're 40 years old, don't you think that at some point in your life it would be nice to break and say, you know, I'm going to take some time off. I'm going to retire. Wouldn't it be, isn't that a right? Shouldn't that be a right? Shouldn't we once again consider our wise elders as wise elders and ask them to play that role rather than Walmart greeter or bricklayer? I mean, Santorum would basically have 70-year-old bricklayers. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with your thoughts and calls here on the Tom Hartman Program. And Bernie Sanders will be with us in about 15 minutes. Stick around. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And Elizabeth Warren yesterday announced her run for the United States Senate and why she was running. This is clip number 7, Chris, if you want to cue this up. And here's Elizabeth Warren and her announcing her candidacy yesterday.
I'm going to do this. I'm going to run for the United States Senate. And the reason is straightforward. Middle-class families have been chipped at, hacked at, squeezed, and hammered for a generation now. And I don't think Washington gets it. Washington is rigged for big corporations that hire armies of lobbyists. A big company like GE pays nothing in taxes, and we're asking college students to take on even more debt to get an education. We're telling seniors they may have to learn to live on less. It isn't right, and it's the reason I'm running for the United States Senate. I fought all my life for working families, and I've stood up to some pretty powerful interests. Those interests are going to line up against this campaign, and that's why I need you. Go to ElizabethWarren.com. Sign up, get involved, be part of this. We can do this together.
And she's up against a really tough opponent in Scott Brown, in as much as Scott Brown has slipped pieces of legislation through Congress that have saved the banksters literally billions of dollars, $19 billion specifically, just with one bill. Now, if a bankster saves you $19 billion, they tend to want to thank you. And Scott Brown is sitting on $10 million in campaign cash. He is ready for this election. And that's just what he's sitting on. I mean, the banksters are going to come in and just pour money into this campaign because they hate Elizabeth Warren. And this is going to be an epic example, struggle, battle. I mean, you know, President Obama has been kind of trying to avoid this by being nice to both sides, because with Citizens United, he knows that if he really POs the banksters, for example, they can take him out. Will they take out Elizabeth Warren? Will that kind of strong rhetoric work? Does democracy still function in the United States? I think that's going to be one of the big questions of the 2012 election. Gil in Hartford, Wisconsin. Hey, Gil, what's up?
Well, you were just talking about being able to raise the retirement age, and I just don't think that people that work hard for a living, right, are going to be capable, physically capable of continuing to do that job.
Right.
Much past 65, you know, we want to push it up to 69, 70, 72.
Right. Well, do you want a 70-year-old bricklayer? That's question number one. But question number two is,
I'm a commercial pilot. I have to go in and take a medical every year. Am I going to be able to pass that medical? And even if I did slip something past the doctor, do you want to get in the plane flown by a 72-year-old man?
Right. And but beyond
being driven by a 72-year-old man or woman.
Right, and beyond that, or work in a building where the steel was carried in by a 72-year-old guy. I mean, but beyond that, there's this concept of, and thank you, Gil, excellent point. There's this concept in America that we historically had of, you know, you work a certain number of years and then you take a break and you get to be, you know, elders. There's a picture, if you go to TomHartmann.com and click on Tom, you'll see a picture of me sitting in a riverbank in northwest Australia with one of the last Aboriginal, they call them kings, the Europeans, of course, named them that, one of the last Aboriginal elders, a fellow by the name of King Tommy George. And I had this fascinating conversation with him in which he said, you know, there's a series of secrets that are given to he was talking about young men. It's the same for girls and women, slightly different, but in his culture, in his Aboriginal group, that tribe, that area, whatever it may be called there. He said that at around the age of seven, there is a set of secrets that are given and a set of obligations that comes with it and capabilities. And then at puberty, there's another one. And each person has a mentor who teaches them this, although in some cases the entire group gets together and teaches them these things. And then there's another set of secrets that are given when you get married. And then there's another set of secrets that are given when your hair first begins to turn gray. Now, this King Tommy George this time is an old guy. I mean, he just had this nimbus of white hair. And he said, and then there's the secret that's given when every hair you have turns white. And I said, wow, that's, what is that secret? And, of course, all my hair isn't white. There's a fair amount of gray in there, but it's not all white. And he looks at me, and he starts laughing, and he says, kind of a, not a funny laugh almost. He says, and he was dead serious when he said this. He said, if I told you, he said, you are not ready. He said, your nervous system couldn't handle it. He said, if I told you, you would burst into flames. That's the concept of wise elders. And it's a concept we've lost in our society. Frank in Cambridge, Mass. Hey, Frank, what's up?
I was want to talk to you about the, thanks for taking my call, by the way, and thanks for free speech. My internet has been down for a week, so I have to do it today to log on to the spreading the news about an
alternate. Great, to the petition. Yeah, thank you. Freespeech.org.
Yeah, I really hope you get this. Yeah, and also I want to correct myself. You're not right 90% of the time. I think you're the teacher, I'm the student. You, as far as I know, you're right 100%.
Well, that's all very kind, Frank. It's unnecessary for the thanks and the greetings and everything, though. We have about 20 or 30 seconds left.
Let me get on to what I was going to say. When I worked at the GE about 45 years ago, the average lifespan for people who asked for retirees who were mandatory to retire at 65 was 2.5 years. The GE would not release the pension books, the money they held in the negotiating with the union. They would never release how much money they had. And I noticed yesterday, it's like we're looking through a looking glass. It's like the rich are investing in poverty.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And by the way, GM used to make money on their pension funds.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Assuming everything worked out and Bernie got to the Senate studios, it'll be Brunch with Bernie when we come back. Get your calls ready. So the reason we're doing Brunch with Bernie today instead of tomorrow is because tomorrow Bernie's going to be flying to Madison, Wisconsin, where he and I and Jim Hightower and a bunch of other great folks are going to be at the Fighting Bob Fest, fightingbobfest.org, if you want to get more information. And, of course, if you're listening in Madison or environs and you want to get up there, it's going to be a great old time, fightingbobfest.org. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, of course, his website. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here with us. Before we start taking calls, you've been busy this week.
It has been an incredibly busy week. Let me just summarize some of the work that's going on here and some of what my office has been doing. We had a very interesting hearing yesterday on a subject, Tom, that doesn't get anywhere near the discussion that it needs. And that is that as the census report data showed, poverty in America is increasing. We now have some 46 million Americans living in poverty. And I think when a lot of people think about poverty, they say, well, that's unfortunate. It's too bad. People are living in not good housing. They don't have a good car. They don't go to the movies on Saturday night. Their kids don't have good clothing. But here was the point of that hearing. The title of that hearing, which involved a number of very brilliant physicians from around the country, was that poverty is a death sentence. It's a death sentence. If you are in the bottom 20% quintile of income earners, you are going to die 6.5 years earlier than if you are in the top 20%. If you're in the bottom 20%, if you're poor, you're going to die 6.5 years earlier than if you are upper income. A study from Harvard University indicated that some 45,000 Americans die each year because they don't have health insurance and can't get to the doctor on time. By the time they do get to the doctor, it is often too late. If you have a college degree, you will live 5 years longer than somebody who has dropped out of high school. Infant mortality rates for African American families is twice that for white families. So what you are looking at is not just an increase in poverty because of this Wall Street-caused recession. You are also looking at more and more people dying earlier than they should because, in fact, in this country today, poverty is a death sentence. And then on top of all of that, what we also have, and what a dubious distinction that is, we have by far the highest poverty rate, childhood poverty rate of any major country on earth. Denmark, the much maligned Scandinavian model, Denmark, it's about 3.6%. Many of the other countries in Scandinavia, the poverty rate for children is under 7%. In our country, it's 21.6%. France, Germany, under 10%. That means you have a whole generation of children who are not getting the nutrition, not getting the education, not getting the nurturing that they need to go out in the workforce and become productive, taxpaying citizens. So we are investing heavily in wars. We give huge tax breaks to the wealthiest people in this country and to the largest corporations. But uniquely in the industrialized world, we have over 20% of our children living in poverty. So that whole issue of how you address poverty is an issue that does not get a lot of discussion, Tom, because many poor people don't vote. And certainly low-income people are not major campaign contributors. So what happens to poor people does not get discussed unless it is discussed by the right wing in terms of making poor people a political football. Okay. Second of all, yesterday, as I've talked on this program in the past, we introduced very significant legislation. We talk a lot about Social Security. Social Security is not going broke. Social Security has not contributed one nickel to the surplus. According to recent reports, Social Security has a $2.5 trillion surplus, can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 28 years. What I did yesterday is introduce legislation with six co-sponsors, did a press conference with Barbara Boxer of California, Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, two of my six co-sponsors, Peter DeFazio of Oregon, who is introducing the same bill in the House. What this bill does is lift the cap on taxable income for all people who are earning above $250,000 so that they will pay 100% of the FICA tax on all of their income, which is what 94% of the American people currently do. Right now, if you're making $50,000, you pay 100% of the FICA tax on your income. You're making $106,000, you do the same. You're making $1 million, you're paying only on the first $106,000. If you do that, if that legislation is passed, Social Security will be strong for the next 75 years. End of discussion. Good for your kids, good for your grandchildren, maybe even your great-grandchildren. That's what we've got to do.
Yeah.
Last point. We are working hard on, obviously, the major issue of our time, a jobs program. Real unemployment, 16%, 25 million people unemployed or underemployed. What do we have to do? In my view, what we have to do is invest very, very heavily in our crumbling infrastructure. Obama mentioned that in his speech. He's right, but we have to do even more. The fastest way to create decent paying jobs and rebuild our country is by investing in infrastructure. We can put millions of people to work, not just blue collar workers, not just laborers, but engineers, scientists as well. Second of all, I think you have to rebuild our energy system. You create jobs doing that. Thirdly, the most controversial element, we need to change our trade policies. Obama is wrong. The Bush trade policies should not be continued. We need a new direction in trade. We've got to demand that corporate America, which has outsourced millions of jobs, starts reinvesting in America, not in China. So those are a few of the things that are taking place in D.C. right now.
That's marvelous. Let's pick up some phone calls.
Let's do it.
Okay. Heidi in Bellevue, Washington. You're on with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Bernie, I just had a baby August 22nd, and we named him John Bernard and after you. And
oh, my goodness.
He grew up to be a good man, and we call him Baby Bernie. And I just wanted to let you know, as I said, you know, first, we'll have a good role model.
Heidi, let me just jump in and say I am very moved by that. That is incredibly kind of you. Congratulations on the baby, and thank you very much. That is a wonderful honor.
I want you to do so much for us. I wanted to do something for you. And we also thought it was a cute name. But I also wanted to tell you I had an unplanned C-section, and just kind of how our medical system is broken down. In my state, you're discharged after 2 days. From a C-section, I was bleeding through the incision, so they had to go back in. So I got an extra day in the hospital. But you know, it's incredibly painful. You can hardly walk or sit up, and you're sent home to take care of a newborn and your other children. And I think that's sort of a sign of how broken down our medical system is. My daughter goes to a French immersion school, and all of her teachers come from France. About half the families are French, and they said, you know, that absolutely would not happen in France. You know, you wouldn't be sent home so early. But I think that's another way our medical system is broken down. And yeah.
Well, Heidi, congratulations on the baby, and I think your criticism is right. I know how difficult family members of mine have had. My daughters have had cesareans. Operations, and you're right. So congratulations, and thank you very much for that great honor.
Shelley in Greenville, Mississippi, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I just want to first say that I enjoy your show. I watch it every day. And to Mr. Bernie Sanders, thank you very much for everything that you do. You seem to be a handful of people who seem to really care about people in general. I'm one of those people. My husband and I don't have insurance, and I don't know, with not even being 40 yet, I feel like I'm dying a slow death. And sometimes the normal people out there lose hope. My husband works 50 hours a week. We try to be good people in society, and it just seems that if you get sick enough, you go to the emergency room, which is a roller coaster because they tell you you need to see specialists, you know, to get your problem fixed. There's tests that need to be done. So you take what medicine you can get that day, and then you have this huge bill, and it's a roller coaster because your credit's bad in the end, even though you paid everything else that you have was supposed to your whole life. These big medical bills come in, you can't pay them. So therefore, your credit's ruined, and you're still in the same place because I still need so many tests done that I can't even begin to find out what's wrong with me. And it scares me that even if I did know what was wrong with me, what would I do then? What would be the answer then?
All right, Shelley, let me ask you, is Shelley still on?
Yeah.
All right, Shelley, first of all, thank you very much for the call. And I want you to know, and I thank you for the call because I know that it is not easy to talk about what's happening in your life and the lives of your family on a television and radio show, which millions of people are listening to. But it is enormously important that you do that because, Shelley, what I want to say to you is the story that you have just told us goes on in every state in the country. That millions and millions of people are going through the same pain. And by you voicing those concerns, it brings people together, makes them understand they are not alone, and it helps us address the absurdity of our healthcare system and the problems of our economic system. So thank you very much for your courage in telling us what you have told us.
Thank you, Shelley. Thank you, Bernie. We'll be right back. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Brunch with Bernie with Senator Bernie Sanders. More with your calls for the senator right after this, a day early.
When many little people in many little places do many little things, then the whole world changes, you see. We are looking for the same thing.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour a day early. Bernie and I are going to be traveling. Bernie's going to be traveling to Madison for the Fighting Bob Fest, fightingbobfest.org, where he will be speaking on Saturday, as will I. And taking your calls, here's Cece in Pagosa Springs, Colorado. Cece, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen. A question, comment. How do we stop the corporate freeloading? They're taking advantage of our government, which they scorn at every chance they get, and then they're taking all our money. They internalize their profits. They externalize the expenses. We pay for everything. They pay for nothing. They need to be stopped dead in their tracks, and I'm afraid that the president and the current political system is not enough. The model is broken. We need a new model. What do you think?
Well, I think you're right, Cece. The model is broken. I think there are people who have the illusion that the United States Congress and the White House are able to regulate Wall Street and large corporations. The truth is quite the reverse. It is Wall Street and large corporations who regulate and control the Congress through their campaign contributions. The Citizens United Supreme Court decision will make a bad situation worse, and then you got all kinds of lobbyists running around here. So it's not the Congress that regulates Wall Street, it's Wall Street and their friends that regulate the Congress. You ask, how do we change that? There's only one way I know how to change that. And that is a broad, activated, grassroots movement from California to Maine that demands that we elect people and we hold people accountable in Washington and our state legislatures who stand up for ordinary people, for a declining middle class, for those people who are slipping into poverty, for our children, for our seniors. They are the vast majority of the people. What we have in recent years, as the census data reveals as clearly as one can want to see, is the middle class is collapsing, poverty is increasing, and the wealthiest people are getting wealthier. The function of Congress is not to represent the rich and the powerful. The function of Congress is to represent those people who are struggling to keep their heads above water, to raise their families with a little bit of dignity, the seniors who are living on $14,000, $15,000 a year, our kids. That's the function of the Congress. And to do that, you do have to start standing up to corporate America. You got to make them offers they can't refuse. And that is, among other things, we got to change our trade policy. They want us to buy their products. When we purchase their products, they make huge profits. And yet we have got to demand that they manufacture those products here in the United States of America. The other thing that happened this week, Tom, is, you know, as I mentioned on the show before, we've been dealing with the Smithsonian museums.
Right.
Here you have government-owned museums, wonderful museums. People should visit them when they come to Washington. Their gift shops were loaded with products made in China and other low-wage countries. We've been working with them. We're making some progress. You know, I'm happy to tell you, remember I mentioned to you that the busts of George Washington and Barack Obama were made in China?
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? They're going to be made in America now.
That's great.
And we're getting some progress with other federal agencies. But bottom line is, these corporations can't stash their money in the Cayman Islands in order to avoid paying their fair share of taxes and then tell us we got to cut Social Security and Medicare to deal with the deficit. That is obscene, and the American people have got to fight back.
Okay. Howie in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. Hi, Tom. I'm the new dealer that called you about 3 weeks ago, and that $447 billion of the Obama jobs so-called creating budget, I would rather, much rather, have my government hire civil engineers and government workers to be on a government payroll to make sure that that funding is distributed properly. You realize, I mean, I'm not a math wizard, but I did the math, and that's about 10 million jobs at $50,000 a year. Now, those people will be paying taxes on that income. I just think handing this money over to private companies is, I think, the government's a better way to go on this thing.
Well, Howie, we're going to
take the money from the government, the administrative costs. I've worked for the Postal Service for 26 years, and it was a fair place to work, had good benefits. I think we need our government.
Well, Howie, let me just say this. Number one, by the way, in terms of the Postal Service, as you are aware of, we are going to have a huge fight on our hands. There are some people who really want to dismember that Postal Service. I'm not one of them. I want to defend it. The times have changed. The Postal Service has got to change. But I don't want to see hundreds of thousands of workers laid off. And there are ways that we can address that problem. But more importantly, I wish that I could tell you that the president's jobs proposal would create 10 million new jobs. It's not going to. The essential problem with the president's proposal are several fold. Number one, A lot of that money, that $447 billion, is not going into investment. It's not going into infrastructure or schools, etc. It is going into tax breaks. And the evidence is pretty clear that tax breaks do not create the kinds of jobs that investment does. I agree with the president, as I said earlier, that we do need to invest in infrastructure. But of that $447, I don't have the paper in front of me, but about $60 billion, I think, 50 plus 10 to an investment bank goes into infrastructure. I would put more money there. I think he's right to talk about rebuilding schools. I think he's absolutely right in helping cities and towns and states make sure that we continue to be able to hire our teachers, our firefighters, our police officers, etc. We need to do that as well. But given the urgency of the moment, the president's proposal is not strong enough, and I'm going to do my best to see that it's stronger, that it in fact creates more jobs.
That's great. Senator Bernie Sanders, you can learn all about it over at sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Tom, thank you very much.
It's much appreciated. Jim Hightower is up next. Did good government or Rick Perry create jobs in Texas?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Jim Hightower on the line with us. Hey, Jim, how you doing?
Great to be with Tom Hartman, straight from the heart, straight from the heartland.
There you go. Actually,
I pulled that up while I was on hold.
I'm
appropriate.
Thank you. I'm here in D.C. You're the national radio commentator, writer, public speaker, author of the book Swim Against the Current. Even a dead fish can go with the flow. Your website is jimhightower.com, Twitter at Hightower News, and you and I are both going to be at fightingbobfest.org at the Fighting Bob Fest in Madison, Wisconsin this weekend. But that's not what I wanted to talk with you about. This Rick Perry death cult, I find this absolutely fascinating. Rick Perry was applauded for being the governor who executed the most people. But there's a troubling piece to that, isn't there?
Well, 234 people.
Yeah.
Not the most, but a lot.
Yeah.
And counting. Many more are on.
Yeah,
death
four
road.
More this week, or
well,
next 2 weeks.
Troubling aspect is that a number of those could well have been innocent. And in fact, one almost certainly was innocent. A fellow who had evidence, or his lawyers had evidence that the prosecutor's evidence had been withheld, that would have exonerated him. And Perry had the opportunity, was it last year, I think, to be able to spare this guy for a while so that evidence could be checked out. Instead, he okayed the execution to go forward.
Yeah, this is, I find this really quite extraordinary. And Rick Perry actually changed the composition of the board that was looking into, I want to say, Mr. Willingham's conviction. This was a father of three children whose house caught on fire. He got out of the house. His kids didn't. He tried to get back in. He was badly burned over much of his body. He was then prosecuted for murder. And after he was executed by Rick Perry, substantial evidence came out that he had been what he had been claiming right up until the moment he died, that it was a horrible accident. He was a grieving father. Was absolutely true, that there was no, they prosecuted him for arson, saying that he killed his kids intentionally by setting his house on fire. And, you know, which in the real world very rarely makes any sense at all. It never makes any sense. And the board that was looking into this seemed like they were going to come to this conclusion that Rick Perry had killed an innocent man. And so he put one of his cronies on that board, and all of a sudden the board is no longer discussing, they're not releasing their claims, their findings.
Well, he dismissed members of the board,
right,
and just dismissed the chair of the board, and put prosecutor, a Republican prosecutor in a neighboring county here who is a Perry supporter, and they basically kill him and then we'll let God sort it all out sort of guy right. in charge of this investigation. And he promptly stalled the investigation until after the Republican primary last year, because Perry was suffering quite a few blows from this. And then he came up for confirmation by the Senate in the legislative session this spring, and could not get it. That is a Republican dominated legislature, by the way. So Perry got rebuked by his fellow Republicans in the state Senate. But meanwhile, Mr. Willingham is deceased.
Yeah. And now,
this guy, I just want to say, I mean, Tom, that this guy really puts the goober in gubernatorial. Rick Perry does. He's done this kind of thing again and again. And this is particularly atrocious, of course, because real lives are at stake and justice is at stake.
Yeah.
But yet there he was in a debate saying, no, he has no trouble with having executed all those people. He is absolutely certain in his mind that you know, which is has a lot of empty space in it, but nonetheless, that he has done the noble thing in executing 234 people. So this man, who claims to be a man of religion and morality, seems to have no conscience at all about doing some rather ugly things.
Right. Also, I understand the Texas law. We're talking with Jim Hightower, an actual Texan and former elected official in Texas, in fact, the Texas Ag Commissioner. I understand that according to Texas law, in order to take a first-degree murder conviction to the death penalty, you have to prove something called future dangerousness. And the guy that Perry is going to execute today, the future dangerousness provision was the result of expert testimony from the state's witness, Dr. Walter Quinanjo, who said that this man should get the death penalty, and I'm quoting the expert now, because he's African-American and the race factor being black increases his future dangerousness. Is this characteristic of Texas?
Not of Texans. It's characteristics of some Texans and a part of Texas that Perry embraces. This has been the problem with the people on death row. Because Perry says, well, they've all been, you know, we have a process that we go through here, and it's exhaustive, and people get to appeal, and then they turn to me and say, it's okay, this person is guilty. But what he doesn't say is that so many of these people on death row have been African American, have been Latino, essentially unrepresented by their own lawyers, because these are poor folks mostly. They do not have access to top-notch lawyers, and so they're appointed public counsel. And many of these counsel people who get appointed, some of them have actually fallen asleep during a trial.
Right.
Others have not prepared their cases, and et cetera. So they've not had fair representation from the get-go.
Yeah, it's amazing. We have about 3 minutes left. I've got two 10-second Rick Perry clips I'd like to play back to back and just turn it over to you, Jim Hightower.
Okay.
Here's clip number three, Chris.
And actually create jobs, sir.
Actually, what a government can do can create an environment where those jobs can be created. Government doesn't create any jobs. They can actually run jobs away.
Okay, and now clip number two.
He has failed to create jobs by relying on bigger government. I've helped create a million jobs during my tenure as the governor of the state of Texas.
So politicians don't create jobs, but Rick Perry created a million. What am I missing here, Jim Hightower?
Well, for Perry, irony is a country somewhere between Iran and Iraq. he doesn't quite link. His mind does not link one statement to another. Of course, government does indeed create jobs. In fact, the million jobs that he talks about having created here in Texas in the last decade, the majority of those jobs came from government. There were increases in public service jobs, and a good number of them, by the way, came as a result of Obama's stimulus program. We were the third largest recipient here in Texas of stimulus funds of any state in the country. So government does indeed create jobs. You might ask a teacher about that, or a firefighter, a police officer. But also government destroys jobs, and that's what Rick Perry has done. He's known as Governor Supercuts down here, not only because of that bounteous crop of hair atop his head. He's the best coiffed presidential candidate we have, including Michelle Bachmann.
Right.
But he is known for that because of the massive cuts that he has made in our budget, all because he created a $27 billion deficit in our state and then has tried to meet that deficit by cutting jobs.
Amazing, amazing. Jim Hightower, jimhightower.com for his commentaries and just a lot of great information. You can subscribe to the Hightower News, Twitter at Hightower News. And Jim, I'll see you this weekend at Fighting Bob Fest in Madison.
Looking forward to it.
Me too, me too. Good to see you again, my friend. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Did you know that the American Jobs Act, the Republicans have their own version of it? Right after this, in your calls.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud.
Okay, it's our geeky science alert. How did gold get on the surface of the planet? Here's the deal. Gold and most of the other the rare earth minerals, they should not be in the crust of the planet. They have an affinity for iron, and when the Earth was created, they all went down into the core. So there's lots of gold at the core of the planet. There shouldn't be any at all on the surface, which is one of the reasons why it's relatively rare. Well, they finally nailed this down, gold and platinum as well. They looked at two isotopes, atomic variants, in tungsten, 4 billion-year-old rocks from Greenland. This was published online yesterday in Nature magazine. And what they found was that all the precious metals that they were able to identify had an atomic signature that indicated that they came from meteorites. Certainly a lot of that stuff was created at when the Earth was formed, but it's all down in the core, which is why you find it in individual spots where you dig down. Oh, hey, look, there's a bunch of it here. That's because a big meteorite hit there sometime in the last 4 billion years. So I find that just fascinating. That's our geeky science alert for the day. And David in Springfield, Massachusetts. Hey, David, what's on your mind today? Oh, it helps if I push the right button. David, you are on the air.
Okay, concerning about the governor of Texas,
yes, sir,
who may be the Republican nominee for president,
right.
I believe the best way to criticize Mr. Perry is to hit him hard on economic issues. I believe, I'm not saying this to insult anyone, but the huge majority of the people that he caused to be executed, I am sure were guilty, and there's a small minority that were innocent.
Yeah, typically it's about 1 in 10 that, you know, when the Innocence Project goes in and looks, they find that about 1 in 10 people on death row are actually innocent.
Concerning Mr. Perry on the Trans-Texas Corridor, if he is hit hard on that issue, and he has supported that in the past, I believe that that is going to damage his candidacy.
You're talking about the road from Mexico to Canada?
Yes. That's an unneeded highway.
Right.
It will do a lot to devastate our economy. It's a NAFTA in reverse. It would cause a huge amount of illegal aliens as well as drug dealers and drugs to come into the country that would be impossible to supervise. And I'll tell you another thing, to go back to the Eisenhower era. When Eisenhower convinced Congress to build the huge highway system of the 1950s,
right,
that was done to help his friends, Detroit, Charlie Wilson. Charlie Wilson's a guy who said back in the 50s, what's good for General Motors is good for America. An incredibly arrogant statement on the part of the president of General Motors, Mr. Wilson, who, among others, helped to put Eisenhower in the White House.
Right.
And we should not allow highways to be the big thing in this country. We should get back to railroads.
Yeah, high-speed railroads, rail, as they're doing in China and Japan and all over Europe. As France did 30 years ago.
Nature, they're more efficient than any highway system could ever be.
You're absolutely right. And more comfortable, frankly. I'd much rather sit in a train, a good train, a high speed. You sit in a high speed train, in Europe or in Asia, and you can sit there, you can have a cup of coffee, you can read the newspaper while you're zooming across the countryside at 210 miles an hour. And here in the United States, our Amtrak trains might hit 70 on a good day, and, because our tracks are so bad. And we've got, and the alternative is to drive, and which is, as you point out, incredibly inefficient to move 6,000 pounds of metal around to carry one person from place to place and use fossil fuels to do it. Excellent point, David. Thank you very much. Bob in Palatine, Illinois. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi there. I'm disappointed I wasn't able to speak with Senator Sanders, but I would appreciate if you, when you speak with him the next time, if you would ask him about Social Security's disability fund, which I have recently become aware of is only solvent for the next 6 years.
Yeah. Bob, I can't commit to ask Bernie anything. It's pretty much the first 15 minutes of the show. Bernie does his riff on what he wants to talk about, and the rest of it is people calling in. I typically don't ask Bernie questions, so I would suggest that the next time Bernie's on, you call him and ask him, and we'll try and get him in. Sometimes people have to call several times before they finally get through to Bernie. In fact, typically, we've got 12 lines coming into here, and they all get slammed when Bernie's on, and it's just, depends on how long his answers are. Michael in Sunrise, Florida. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to make an observation. Yesterday on Democracy Now!, Amy showed a visual sequence of the working poor people.
Right.
And it struck me. I mean, it really struck me to see this. I mean, we hear about it all the time, but you never see it.
Yep.
And it just really struck me, and I think we could make our case a lot better if on our shows we show more of this.
Yeah, the closest that we got to it on network television was the Jerry Springer show, which was make fun of the working poor. You're absolutely right. And the reason, of course, is that the working poor are not large consumers, and so doing any kind of programming that might be of interest to them is not going to get them to buy more, Clairol shampoo or whatever. Or the greatest new drug from Siba Geigy or whatever. But
what I mean, Tom, is on news shows, even shows like yours, it was stunning.
I'm right with you, Michael. And Amy does brilliant news and reporting. And one distinction that I'd like to point out, and that is that Amy Goodman's show, Democracy Now!, is a news show and a brilliant one. We're doing it. This is basically a talk show. This is opinion. This is not news. I mean, we talk about the news, and we will present the news. And we've talked our fair share about poverty, and thanks for your suggestion. Robert in Fort Lauderdale. Whoop. Hey, Robert, hang on. I missed that cue. Hang on just a second. We will pick up your call after the break. It's 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with more of your calls after this. Rand Paul. I have to share with you Ron Paul's newest theory about why Africa is poor. It's got nothing to do with colonization. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Pat Robertson, should you divorce your wife if she has Alzheimer's?
The chicken hawks are full of squawks. Deep in the heart of Texas, the oil wells.
Yep, that's the old Rick Perry thing down there, deep in the heart of Texas. It's pretty amazing. It is pretty amazing. This is, here's an interesting concept. When you get married, typically there's this phrase in the vows, till death do us part. This is Pat Robertson being interviewed on his own TV show, The Billionaire. And I don't know the status of his marriage or his life or anything. This is presented in a vacuum and probably best presented as such, because I'd like to raise it as an abstract question. First of all, here's the clip. This is Pat Robertson.
Pat, this is Andreas, who says, I have a friend whose wife suffers from Alzheimer's. She doesn't even recognize him anymore, and as you can imagine, the marriage has been rough. My friend has gotten bitter at God for allowing his wife to be in that condition, and now he started seeing another woman. He says that he should be allowed to see other people because his wife, as he knows her, is gone. I'm not quite sure what to tell him. Please help.
That is a terribly hard thing. It is. I hate Alzheimer's. It is one of the most awful things, because here's the loved one. This is the woman or man that you have loved for 20, 30, 40 years, and suddenly that person is gone. They are gone. So what he says basically is correct, but I know it sounds cruel, but if he's going to do something, he should divorce her and start all over again.
Divorce her and start all over again. Now, you know, my own personal experience with Alzheimer was my mother died of Alzheimer's, but she recognized, I mean, up until the last couple of weeks, she knew who I was. She knew who, you know, my brothers were. I mean, there were days she came and went, I suppose, but I can't imagine my dad saying he's going to kick her out, or vice versa. And for that matter, my brother and his wife, my brother Stan and his wife, took Mom in, and she lived in their home with Alzheimer's after my dad died in 2006 up until she died. It was the year before last. And cared for her. I mean, the exact opposite of what Pat Robertson is recommending. So, I don't know. It's tough to lay morality on people and say, oh, this is what you have to do. But the whole idea that once somebody gets Alzheimer's, they should be dumped by their family. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised that this, you know, is coming from the guy who said that 9/11 was because we allow gays to be gay in the United States, a man who presents himself as a Christian leader but promotes hatred and fear, and is worth $1 billion that he made hustling Christianity on radio and television. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised. But anyhow, I'm curious your thoughts on that, 866-987-THOM, if you have any on that. In some ways, maybe it's not even, you know, I don't know, so you may not want to comment. But in the meantime, we got a bunch of folks who've been on hold for a while waiting to comment on other things. Robert in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to ask you, and you touched on this while I was holding, but what's your opinion on Congressman Wiener's seat being lost to a Republican for the first time in something like over 60 years?
I think it's an indication of how weak right now the Democratic Party in general and President Obama specifically are. And it's what I've been saying for 3 years. He needs to be FDR, not Bill Clinton. These are not Bill Clinton times. You can be a moderate Democratic president. You can reconcile things with the Republicans and end welfare as we know it and declare the era of big government over, and even bring in NAFTA, the WTO, and all that, as Bill Clinton did during times of prosperity. And people will cut you a pass. In fact, people may even admire you for it. Bill Clinton was very popular, but, you know, among Republicans and Democrats. But the times demand a particular type of leader. And when President Obama campaigned on change and came into a depression, 800,000 jobs a month being lost, he needed to do more than just put a Band-Aid on that, you know, stop the hemorrhaging, and then go off and fix health care as a legacy that he could stand on. I realize it was a political calculation. It was made not just by him, but by people on his staff. They clearly did not realize that we were on the brink of a depression. They thought it was just another cyclical recession, that we'd be out of it by the time the elections came around. He's starting now to do the right thing. He's starting to, you know, Bill Clinton's war room, his campaign room, had a sign on the wall that said, "It's the economy, stupid." And Obama is starting to figure that out. And his campaign is starting to figure that out, and I wish them well. J.D. in Napa, California. Hey, J.D., what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I was very interested in what you had to say about Pat Robertson. My husband and I moved to Napa County, or actually Vallejo, which is in Solano County, 12 years ago. And the only people I could find that really I connected with were Christians. And it's been a fascinating journey. And one of the things that I've discovered in my studies is simply this, that religion and faith are two different things. And that in this country, these right-wing extremists have hijacked the religion of Christianity. And they're making it appear like it's something that I've not seen in my personal day-to-day life. And what's going on is very terrifying, because there are groups, Christian churches, that propagate this GOP right-wing insanity.
Yes.
And I find myself at a really remarkable point in being almost 60 years old in this country, and like your earlier call last hour, Shelley, in the same situation she's in.
Yeah, and she was in her 30s.
I like your comments on this. I think Pat Robertson should be taken off the air. I think the man is just twisted.
Wouldn't it be interesting if the reason that Pat Robertson gave such a bizarre answer is that he himself has early Alzheimer's?
It would be what my husband says. They've got to eat. They're young now.
And next week his wife divorced him. The irony machine in me just kicked in. I wouldn't wish that on anybody, having seen the horrors of Alzheimer's. But
Tom, my mother-in-law had early onset. Well, not early onset. She had dementia, drug-induced dementia, which was diagnosed as Alzheimer's, to save the doctor who had put her on 15 drugs, and seven of which were only given to people who were institutionalized, and she was not.
Yeah. This is
okay. So, and I'm going to throw my mother-in-law out. It doesn't work that way. Not in America.
Yeah, I'm with you.
People live.
Yeah, this is something very similar happened to my dad's mother, and she had had high blood pressure her entire life. It runs in my father's family and my family, and it had never been diagnosed. I mean, she'd never been to the doctor, and she was in her 70s walking down the street in New Ego, Michigan, and slipped and fell and injured or broke her hip. And they took her into the hospital, and they said, holy cow, look at this. Her blood pressure is like, 160 over 100 or so, whatever it was. And they put her immediately on blood pressure-dropping medication, and she never was grandma again. I mean, it wiped her personality clean. She didn't recognize anybody, and she lived, for another decade. And my father was very – it was one of the reasons, I think, that he went so long without medical care, because he was just horrified by the medical system. That's a whole other story. Anyhow, Howard in Seattle. Hey, Howard, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Regarding Pat Robertson, so since he's telling this man to divorce his wife because she has Alzheimer's, clearly she can't take care of herself, does this mean the socialist state should now take care of her?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm guessing the answer would probably be yes. Let the socialist state take care of her, unless Robertson's church is offering to. I didn't hear that, though, in the answer at all. Jim in New Baltimore, Michigan. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I mean, the tenets of marriage, through sickness and health till death do us part.
Yeah.
I mean, he had a no-brainer answer, and he came up with that. Why aren't there other, pastors and preachers just, knocking down his door saying, we fight about marriage acts, and you're saying this?
Right. He's opposed to gay marriage. That's the reason why we had 9/11. In other words, if two people love each other, they can't get married. But if one of them gets Alzheimer's, hey, to hell with you. You're out of here. It's really quite remarkable. It really is. Jim, thank you very much. Randy in Linwood, Washington. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Christianity is not a religion. It's a mafia cult.
Well, I don't even want to say denominations. Some churches are run as cults, but others aren't. The United Church of Christ, for example, I have tremendous respect for. That's the church that the big networks refused to run their ads in 2004, I think, during the Bush campaign, when they showed a gay couple and a biracial couple coming up to the door of a church and being turned away, and then they said, you know, here at the United Church of Christ, we would never turn anybody away. It's a very, very progressive church, and a Christian church. So I was raised in the Methodist Church. I think the Methodist Church has gotten quite progressive over the years in some parts. But some of these far-right Protestant fundamentalists who have been, George W. Bush's job in his dad's presidential campaign was to bring these people into the Republican Party. This was back around 1988. And he did. Here they are.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to continue our conversation and check in with the Talk Radio News Service right after this, 45 minutes past the hour.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right, here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I believe that the Talk Radio News Service is just calling in right now. That's it. Okay, on line 12, it's Ellen Ranner with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Ellen, what's going on in the world at this moment?
Well, basically, it's very interesting. The Republicans are doing a pretty coordinated attack on the president's jobs plans. Speaker Boehner today actually addressed the Washington Economic Club, and he said that their plan for job creation was to urge deficit reduction on this, and the super committee, who, by the way, did not meet in public today, to lay the groundwork for what the tax code would be. He said that if their tax plans would work, but he was afraid that the tax proposals in the Obama plan would only make the tax code more complex. So now, understand that that's happening, shortly after noon today. And then, at about 11:30, I attended a briefing by Senator Cornyn from Texas at the Senate galleries, and they were going on. They had a little show and tell with all the regulations, and he was saying, "Well, there's all these regulations that." That the Republican, that the Democrats have put in. He called it the EPA run amok. He said the EPA was out of control, that they had lost 500 jobs from just one of their regulations alone. This had to do with electricity production and sort of clean air, that kind of thing. He said that what was so amazing, and it was the juxtaposition. He's one saying, well, we're going to lose 8% of all our electrical production because of the EPA ruling. But in the same sentence, or a couple of sentences later, he said, well, you know, we've had triple-digit hot temperatures in Texas recently and over the year, and this is why this is such a problem. Well, of course, does he want to say that we're not having climate change?
Right.
It was like I was saying, the guy is...
Well, the other thing that the Republicans seem to miss is that if you look at the history of regulations in the United States, When we said you've got to have particle scrubbers, for example, on smokestacks, or that you've got to, you can't have poisons and plastics and toys and things. In every single case, what those regulations did was they didn't cause people to say, oh, well, in that case, we'll just stop making electricity, or in that case, we'll just stop making toys. They figured out ways to do it differently, to do it better, to do it safer. In other words, they innovated. They invented new things. They invented new technologies. Regulation actually leads to innovation and adds jobs, because now people have to figure out, okay, you know, if we're going to make a safer car, how are we going to engineer that? How are we going to, you know, there's an entire industry out there called airbags that didn't exist before a government regulation went into place. End of rant.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, it's interesting because a lot of liberals are saying, well, they're not regulating enough. He said that there has been so much more regulation under this administration.
Yeah. Well, you know, if it's keeping us safe and it's keeping our air and water drinkable and it's reducing the cancer levels and it's keeping our kids from getting sick and it's forcing industry to take some of that $2 trillion that they're sitting on and invest it in new ways of doing things that are less dangerous and toxic, I'm all for it.
Right. I'm not going to disagree with you on that one. Okay. Some other interesting issues going on today. Sort of a mixed economic report where there has been a mortgage rate hitting record lows. Industrial production did increase only 0.2%. July's almost 1%, 0.9%. There was an increase by 2.6% in automobile production. So this was a lot better. On the other hand, there were more joblessness, more people filing for jobless claims. So, you know, it's a mixed bag, but it's not the total doom and gloom that that some of our friends on the right are saying.
Okay.
I mean, it may be ultimately, but it's looking a little interesting. Also, the House today is going to vote on a bill that would limit the National Labor Relations Board's enforcement power. It would actually stop them from ordering any employer to shut down plants or relocate work. If a company violates labor laws. This had to do with that the unionized workers and
the Boeing plant
moving to South. Yeah, the Boeing issue.
So they ruled in favor of the workers or in favor of Boeing?
They ruled in favor of. Well, they're basically saying that the National Labor Relations Board cannot rule in favor of the workers. Basically, that's what they said.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then they're touting all kinds of, well, what American people believe, and that Rasmussen says, which is not, you know, they're known for a little bit of a right-wing tilt there, that 64% believe that Boeing has the right to open a plant in South Carolina.
Sure.
Now, this is very interesting. I don't know if we talked about it yesterday, but as you know, there were attacks on the Kabul embassy, and Leon Panetta met with reporters, and you know, I've followed Leon Panetta since he was in Congress, always liked the guy, but I have to tell you, this is a little, he is now, the way they're framing the U.S. embassy attack in Kabul is that they really can't win in the field, and so they're attacking the quote-unquote soft targets like the embassies, U.S. embassy in Kabul,
right.
Because the insurgents can't win. Now, I'm not there, but I think the attack on our embassy was a pretty severe attack this week.
Ouch. It's we're occupying their country. I mean, people tend not to like to have their countries occupied. It's time for us to bring our troops home. I think that this is just more evidence of it.
Right. There's also there was some interesting discussion today from the Defense Department, there was a confirmation hearing before the Senate Armed Services Committee of a guy named Ashton Carter. He said the Pentagon needs to focus on efficiency. That's not exactly new science, but
okay. Great. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Great to have you on. If you are flying on a plane, if you are planning on flying on a plane while having brown skin, don't miss what's coming next. It's stunning.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. A couple of things I wanted to share with you real quickly, and then we'll pick up your calls and thoughts on this. This Pat Robertson. I played this clip in the last segment, and here it is again. This is from Pat Robertson's own TV show, his 700 Club.
Pat, this is Andreas, who says, I have a friend whose wife suffers from Alzheimer's. She doesn't even recognize him anymore, and as you can imagine, the marriage has been rough. My friend has gotten bitter at God for allowing his wife to be in that condition, and now he started seeing another woman. He says that he should be allowed to see other people because his wife, as he knows her, is gone. I'm not quite sure what to tell him. Please help.
That is a terribly hard thing. It is. I hate Alzheimer's. It is one of the most awful things because here's the loved one. This is the woman or man that you have loved for 20, 30, 40 years, and suddenly that person is gone. They are gone. So what he says basically is correct, but I know it sounds cruel, but if he's going to do something, he should divorce her and start all over again. But
now, let me throw this into the context of somebody who's, you know, 25 or 30 years old, and their partner has some horrible brain damage or something. It's what should they do? Well, that's where it gets to be a tough one. Right. I mean, Terry Schiavo's husband, for example, I don't know if he divorced her or not, but he certainly continued to care for her. But he also had a relationship with somebody else because she was gone. And she had a traumatic brain injury. I mean, this was she was dead. And the right wing Christians like Pat Robertson were keeping her alive with feeding tubes, but her brain was dead. I think that's arguably a different thing, but. You know, that's the arguably part of it is what makes all these moral questions so very interesting. Speaking of moral questions, if you are brown-skinned and thinking of flying, you may want to ask the gate agent to be sure not to seat you near other people of similar colored skin. This is a true story. Yesterday, there was or maybe it was the day before yesterday, I remember hearing this on the news that there were two, that NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD had launched two F-16 jets to follow a Frontier Airlines flight from Denver all the way to Detroit. Why? Because two men of Indian ancestry were seated in a row, and a woman who was a housewife from Ohio, this is how she describes herself, a half-Jewish, half-Arab housewife. In other words, that's her description of herself. You look at the picture, she's got that olive kind of Mediterranean complexion, and sitting with two Indian guys. And somebody saw the three of them and thought, it must be a conspiracy. They didn't even know each other. But the gate agent seated them together. Somebody on the airplane freaked out. The pilot said he didn't care. The suspicious activity was that the two Indian guys, one went to the bathroom, and when he came back, the next one went to the bathroom. I mean, this is how paranoid we've become. And so, somebody and the pilot claims he didn't call for NORAD. And then not only that, when they arrived here, this is where it gets the Tanya Somander reporting this story. She says, after the crew reported the two people had spent an extraordinarily long time in the bathroom, the jets escorted the plane to its destination in Detroit. Then, according to the reports, the half Arab, half Jewish housewife. A SWAT team of about 10 police boarded the plane with machine guns and three dogs and approached her and the two men in their aisle and handcuffed them and escorted them off the plane. She said, before I knew it, about 10 cops, some in what looked like military fatigues, were running toward the plane carrying the biggest machine guns I've ever seen, bigger than what the guards carry at the French train station. My last tweet, majorly armed cops coming aboard. So she's tweeting this, right? She thinks, oh, this is interesting. Look at this. They're storming the plane. She says, someone shouted for us to place our hands on the seats in front of us, heads down. The cops ran down the aisle, stopped at my row, and yelled at the three of us to get up. Can I bring my phone, I asked. This is the housewife, half Jewish, half Arab. She says, can I bring my phone, I asked. What a cliffhanger for my Twitter followers. No, the cop said, grabbing my arm a little harder than I would have liked. He slapped metal cuffs on my wrist and pushed me off the plane. The three of us, two Indian men living in the Detroit metro area, and me, a half Arab, half Jewish housewife living in suburban Ohio, were being detained. They were interrogated. They were strip searched. They were kept for hours because, quote, someone on the plane had reported that the three of us in row 12 were conducting suspicious activity. Have we become, I mean, this is, we were not, I was going to say, we were not a fearful country before George Bush and his response to 9/11. It's not altogether true, though. Fear has always sold in the United States. That's why the Ku Klux Klan did so well in the early part of the 20th century. Fear has always sold. And George Bush, he could have calmed us down and the world and said, you know, this is a criminal act. It's a terrible, horrible thing. We're going to find the criminals and prosecute them. But instead, he created this huge national security apparatus where the Republican senator who is largely responsible for creating the TSA specifically is coming out now and saying, you know, I've created a monster. It was supposed to be a $1 billion agency. It's now a $9 billion agency. It's over the top. And it's not, and this isn't to pick on the TSA, it's the idea that we should all be afraid all the time. You want to be afraid of something? 700 people a year are hit by lightning. The average number of people in the United States killed by terrorist acts since 9/11 has been 13. So 13 people a year killed by terrorist acts. That includes Christian terrorism, Jewish terrorism, Hispanic terrorism. Most of that is in Puerto Rico. It's the Puerto Rican independence movement. According to the FBI, that's the largest, actually, chunk of all the terrorist acts in the United States. And Muslim terrorism, which accounts for only 6%, by the way. And you can find the stats over at FBI.gov. So, you know, you're more likely to be struck by lightning. You're more likely to die of a dog bite. 50,000 Americans die every year because of car accidents. And it used to be 50,000 a year from drunk driving. I don't know if that stat still holds. It's a few years old. But it's sure a hell of a lot higher than being afraid of terrorists. And yet there's a $42 million a year Islamophobia industry. Industry teaching us to be afraid of Muslims that the Center for American Progress has uncovered by just going through IRS figures and figuring out, you know, where are these people getting their money from? The David Horowitzes of the world, the Frank Gaffneys of the world, the ones who show up on Fox all the time. Fear sells. Glenn Beck has a whole legion of fearful followers who are paying him. You know, he's got a couple million people who are paying $9 a month to watch him on the internet now. It's like fear sells. And it shouldn't in this country. We should be the land of the free and the home of the brave. What happened to that? We're the land of the fearful and the home of the trembling? The home of, hey, there's three people sitting together on an airplane and they all have brown skin. There must be something wrong. What?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And then you get Christian leaders saying if your wife gets Alzheimer's, divorce her. Well, Pat Robertson, I'm not sure he's a Christian or a leader, but you get the point.
What you gonna do? Now you say you won't change. But if you don't change yourself, you have no right to.
Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Marie in Edgebel, Colorado?
Edgebel, Colorado.
Okay, what's on your mind, Marie?
Well, I'm clergy. Mm-hmm. This issue with Pat Robertson and Ron Paul really interests me. Pat Robertson saying you should divorce your Alzheimer's-addled spouse, and Ron Paul saying, you know, no help for people who are sick. It just sounds to me like it's a huge failure of any form of compassion whatsoever. I was pastoring an inner-city church in the 80s when the group homes and shelter shops were shut down. You know, let the nice church people take care of those folks who are mentally challenged or mentally ill. And the homeless population just went up exponentially. I'd go to work, and there were homeless folks sitting in the doorway to my office waiting for help. I had no money to give them in an inner city church. And now what's happening as the middle class is being devastated is that middle class people have no money to give to those kinds of charitable efforts.
Right.
They don't have the money to give to to fund, in my own church, we have a food bank, we do food distributions, clothing distributions, we're doing a soup kitchen, and I have just been reduced to half time because my churches are broke.
Right.
We're
and
doing everything to make a difference.
Yeah, this
and we're
is
broke.
This is the new America. This is the America that 30 years of Reaganomics has brought us, is the devastation of the middle class. And as you correctly point out, Ronald Reagan basically ended federal subsidies for state mental hospitals, and they closed all over the country. And as a result, we've got, you know, those old enough to remember know that before the 1980s, there was a very small homeless population, and they tended to be, you know, the old hobos, in quotes, people who just chose to live on the streets. And now it's mentally ill people, by and large. So there's that. But I'm curious, as clergy, your thoughts on Pat Robertson's argument that he divorced his wife with Alzheimer's. And here's the other one. You mentioned Ron Paul. Ron Paul's, you know, in 2008, he was his campaign manager who raised millions of dollars for him. Ron Paul has chosen not to give his, this was the guy who was in charge of it. This is a full-time employee, right? This is the guy who's running his campaign. He has chosen not to give them health insurance because the added expense could instead be used to pay for the campaign, and getting Ron Paul elected is the greater good. And this guy got pneumonia and died of pneumonia in 2008 during the campaign, his campaign manager, and he had no health insurance, and his family is now stuck with and being harassed to pay a $400,000 medical bill, Ron Paul's former campaign manager, because the Ron Paul campaign doesn't provide health care. And Ron Paul, who says, oh, you should just go to people and ask for charity, Ron Paul and his campaign are not offering to pay the $400,000 for this guy's family.
What's an absolute collapse of, again, any kind of compassion? To me, this is evil. That's what immorality looks like. This is what total degradation of any kind of sense of we're all in this together looks like.
I think it's a devastation of America's traditional values. It's just extraordinary. Marie, thank you very much for the call, and thank you for the great work that you're doing with the church. It is important that we have, I think, people of goodwill in those positions. Steve in Mojave, California. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, it's Dave.
Oh, Dave, I'm sorry.
Hey, that's okay. Yeah, the last time I called, we were talking about Reagan's 100th birthday and how they were trying to canonize him, and you're bringing it back up today. It makes me think we haven't uncanonized him yet, have we?
Not yet.
After that debate that they had in the Reagan Library. I wanted to talk about Pat Robertson, and I appreciate the last caller being of a religious bent. I'm not of that bent, but the religious belief from the Christian belief is that the mind and the body are not connected, that the soul, you know, sort of inhabits the body, and that it goes on after the death of the body. And that's a theory that I understand is called dualism. Have you heard of that idea?
I have.
That there's two different, you know, there's the mind, right, and the body, and they're not connected.
Right. Or there's the soul and the mind and the
belief
body.
That the mind and body are connected, basically. They're
right.
One. So that when the body dies, the soul is basically turned off. It's
right.
It's done.
Right.
Robertson, you know, he seems to be going more with a monism type belief, that once the person that he was talking about, once the mind was damaged, that somehow
the soul has left.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't exist.
But how? Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. It is. Go ahead.
Well, it just seemed like such a shallow, even from a religious point of view, a shallow belief system that he was spouting, and sort of the emptiness of his religious belief. And I felt that it was also morally bereft. I appreciated you talking about your own mom and what your family went through with her Alzheimer's.
And all credit to my brother and his wife who took her in. I didn't do that. Stan did.
How did your dad handle it? Because he was around when she had Alzheimer's.
My dad was helped her hide it, basically. I mean, we all knew that Mom was a little daffy, that she'd forget things, you know, she'd mix things up and whatnot. But it literally wasn't until the day after Dad died that all of us suddenly realized how bad Mom was. He was always her protector, and he covered up things for her. He would finish her sentences for her. He would remind her of things in ways that it didn't look like he was reminding her. He kind of kept her there, you know? And my mom, when my dad died, was together enough to realize, and I'm sure that she and my dad had had many conversations about this, that she wouldn't know, because she went to my brother and said, I realize that it's not protocol at a funeral to take a picture of the person in the casket, but would you please take a picture of Carl, my husband, my dad, in the casket, and so that I can put it next to my bed, because I know that the time will come when I'll wake up and not remember that he's dead. And, I mean, that's when it really gets real for you. I'm having a hard time talking about this, so I'm gonna, fortunately, there's a break. Steve, thank you for the call. We'll be back. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the incredibly ugly. And more of your calls. Stick around. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very diagonutically ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good. William Sessions, the former FBI director under Ronald Reagan, has joined the cause to prevent Troy Davis from being executed in Georgia next week. Serious doubts have been raised over whether or not Davis committed the 1989 murder of a police officer, yet the execution is still going forward as planned. In an op-ed published in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Sessions wrote, "When it comes to the sentence of death, there should be no room for doubt. I believe there is no more serious crime than the murder of a law enforcement officer who is putting his or her life on the line to protect innocent bystanders." That, by the way, is what this fellow is accused of having done, killed a cop. "However, justice is not done if the wrong man is punished," said Mr. Sessions. "Thanks to efforts like Mr. Sessions, the media has given this case more and more attention in recent days. So let's hope Georgia doesn't go the route of Rick Perry's Texas and execute an innocent man." The bad. Greg Gutfeld, the new rising star at Fox so-called News, weighed in on the president's handling of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict by going after Jewish liberals. Gutfeld said, "I never understood how Jewish people can be liberal. I don't understand it. Sorry." Maybe because they actually have compassion and don't think our government economy should just be handed over to millionaires and billionaires? I don't know. Gutfeld said his piece on the new Fox show, The Five, which replaced Glenn Beck's show. I guess Fox figured they need five political hacks to replace the kings of all hacks, the king of all hacks in that particular time slot. But if Gutfeld keeps up with his ravings, then he may be able to fill Beck's clown shoes all on his own. And the very, very ugly Mitt Romney. So much for Mitt being the reasonable Republican. At a town hall meeting in Arizona yesterday, Mitt spoke about who he thought would be an ideal running mate for vice president. And guess who he used as a model? None other than the man without a heartbeat, Dick Cheney. Romney said, "Whether you agree or disagree with Cheney, this is a man of wisdom and judgment, and he could have been president of the United States. That's the kind of person I'd like to have, a person of wisdom and judgment." And a war criminal? That's right. Mitt Romney wants a war criminal as his VP. Unfortunately, given Cheney's poor health, Mitt might have to look elsewhere. Luckily, I hear Gaddafi's looking for a new job. That's very, very ugly, Mitt. 866-97-THOM, 866-745-2667, our telephone numbers, and amazing. Francis in Baltimore. Hey, Francis, what's on your mind?
Tom, this is about Ron Paul, being a libertarian.
Yeah, and not providing health insurance to his campaign manager, who then dies and leaves a $400,000 bill to his family.
A libertarian, you pay your own way.
Right.
Right? Why does he need campaign contributions from people if he has to pay his own way?
Ha! You've nailed it, Francis.
Why? Well, I mean, there's a way to create millions of jobs.
There you go.
How you do that?
What's that?
Everybody that's unemployed moves in with the Republicans.
Okay. Thank you, Francis. Thank you. A bit of levity much needed. Rudy in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Rudy, what's up?
Hey, Tom. On the Pat Robertson thing, it sounds like he is weighing the relative importance of different types of sin. You know, so the husband who is, in a sense, cheating on his wife, it sounds like he's advising him to divorce the wife because he's cheating on her rather than, you know, the importance of taking care of and, you know, sticking to the vow of till death do you part.
Right. And I'll tell you, if it was me and I was the one who was gone, and Louise wanted to carry on a relationship with somebody else, as long as she's making sure somehow, and she doesn't even have to physically be there to do it, but, you know, making sure that whatever's left of me is not in pain, is comfortable, I have no problem with that. You know, if I'm not, you know, if I'm mentally not around, but to divorce and then walk away from, that's a very, you know, that you know, I get your point, Rudy. I get your point. Thank you very much for the call. Interesting. Liz in Portland. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi. First of all, I want to say thank you so much for keeping me sane.
Well, thank you. It's not necessary. The thanks are not necessary, but appreciate it.
Okay. I'm Jewish, and I'm liberal. Hey, and every Jew I know is liberal. And so I think that whoever is out there touting that Jews should not be liberal or don't expect us to be are really misguided, especially given the long history of abuse. Anyway, I also appreciate you talking about the United Church of Christ and bringing that out, because that is a beautiful, wonderful denomination, and even I go to that church from time to time, even though I'm Jewish. I'm in a lot of despair about what is going on. When I heard the audience go into applause at the debates, hearing all the people that Perry put to death,
right,
it made me physically ill. Physically ill. Just as the Ron Paul thing with the let him die, let him die. What's going on? I've been here a while. I'm probably older than you. I don't know. But I'm old enough to have marched with Martin Luther King. And after 45 years, this is just the worst I've ever seen in this country. And I don't know what to do. I want to do something. And I've been a political activist since I was 12 or 14.
Sure.
And I just feel that everything is useless now.
Liz, this too shall pass. You know, Thomas Jefferson, maybe Jacob could track it down for me and get it. Just Google Thomas Jefferson and what was the word that he used? It wasn't drag, the witches. Thomas Jefferson and the time of witches. And basically what he was talking about was the John Adams presidency. In fact, I wrote an op-ed about it for Common Dreams years ago. If Jacob plugged Thomas Jefferson, witches, Tom Hartman into Google, I'll bet it would pop right up, and I would love to share that quote with you. But here's the context of the quote, and that was that Jefferson was vice president, because back then, whoever got the most votes became president, the second most votes became vice president. And so John Adams was the president, second president of the United States, and Thomas Jefferson was the vice president. And by this point in time, these guys were not talking to each other. They did not like each other at all because their politics were so different. John Adams was not a religious fundamentalist, but a fundamentalist conservative. He had ordered that whenever he and his wife, Abigail, came through a town, that the cannons, the local militia, had to come out and fire guns in the air, and everybody had to had to shout, "God save President Adams and his wife." He passed in 1898. He passed the Alien and Sedition Laws that made it a crime for newspaper editors to write anything about John Adams that was negative. And he put Ben Franklin's grandson, Benjamin Franklin Bach, who published a newspaper called The Aurora in Massachusetts, put him in prison. In fact, the day that he signed the legislation, and he was stuck there for 2 years, kid lost his paper. He put over 20 newspaper publishers in prison. Matthew Lyon, the congressman from Vermont, called him out on the floor of the House. Roger Griswold, the Federalist, the today's Republicans from Connecticut, came over and started beating him up with a poker from the fire. So John Adams had Matthew Lyon arrested and stuck on a horse and from Washington D.C. up to Vermont, and they put him in an unheated jail cell in Vergennes, Vermont, for 2 years for the crime of sedition of speaking. And what he said on the floor of the House, by the way, what Matthew Lyon said was that Griswold and Adams were looking out for the interests of the well-born and the well-bred rather than the average yeoman, the average working person. That was his crime. And so, you know, Jefferson was like looking at this and just in despair. I mean, he was watching his country turn into a nation of fear and loathing. The XYZ affair, this happened the same year, 1898, as I recall. And this was where John Adams had sent John Marshall, actually, the guy who would ultimately become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and two others over to France to negotiate. And I have the quote here. Here's the quote. "A little patience," Jefferson said, "and we shall see the reign of witches pass over. Their spell dissolved, and the people recovering their true sight, restoring their government to its true principles. It is true that in the meantime we are suffering deeply in spirit and incurring the horrors of a war and long oppressions of enormous public debt. If the game runs against us sometimes at home, we must have patience till luck turns, and then we shall have an opportunity for winning back the principles we have lost. For this is a game where principles are the stake." Not at stake, the stake. And so, you know, with all the stories that I told you to provide the context for that quote, I mean, he was just in this horrible position. The XYZ affair, Adams had sent these guys over. Somebody, some local criminals tried to bribe them. John Adams almost started a war with France over it. He used it as an issue in the election of 1800, just the same way George Bush did in 2004, the whole, you know, Osama bin Laden thing. That's what Jefferson was talking about. And we shall see the reign, you know, now, witches was a negative term back then. I don't think it necessarily should be now, but you get the point. And
yeah.
So it's like, you know, we have, I guarantee you, Liz, there were times when Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who didn't live to see women vote, felt that, you know, why are we doing this? There had to be times when Martin Luther King, who didn't live to see the ultimate outcome of his own works, had to think, you know, why am I doing this? But it will come. This, I have great faith in this country and in our people, and we just need to keep fighting.
I mean, that's how I feel. I don't know if it's going to last, but this country is going to
survive. Must, Liz. It must. We're out of time. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more. More from Thomas Jefferson and your calls right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Hey, by the way, please go to freespeech.org and sign the petition to help Free Speech TV and this show get picked up by Comcast. Comcast should be allocating time to non-corporate TV and independent shows. We need that in America, and you can help out now. I know we have a lot of calls. I will get back to you as quickly as I can, but I just want to share with you this letter by Thomas Jefferson. I discovered this reading his collected works. Louise and I bought a house in Vermont and found in the attic of the carriage house the complete 20-volume set of the collected, or maybe it's 10 volumes, whatever it was, the collected works of Thomas Jefferson. It's only been published once in 1908 and by the Thomas Jefferson Society. And I spent 2 years reading them and wrote two books as a result of them. One of them was called What Would Jefferson Do? And this letter was one of the ones I found, and it was on June 1st, 1798. He's vice president. His president, Adams, is already rounding up newspaper editors and dissidents. He sits down and writes a letter to his old friend John Taylor. Now, John Taylor was a fellow Democratic Republican. Keep in mind, Jefferson founded what's today's modern Democratic Party. And 2 decades later, 20 years later, Taylor would write about this, he wrote a book called Construction Construed and Constitutions Vindicated, noting, and this is Taylor's quote, "A government is substantially good or bad in the degree that it produces happiness or misery of a nation." So Jefferson is writing to this friend of his, John Taylor, and he writes about in this letter. He said, it is true that we are, several of the states had kind of gone over to John Adams' side. They were gung-ho for the Alien Sedition Act. And he writes, it is true that we are completely under the saddle of Massachusetts and Connecticut, and that they ride us very hard, cruelly insulting our feelings, as well as exhausting our strength and subsistence. These states had become essentially Federalist states. And so they were going gung-ho with John Adams, turning America into basically a fascist country. He said, their natural friends, the three other eastern states, join them with a sort of family pride, and they have the art to divide certain other parts of the Union so as to make use of them to govern the whole. This is not new, Jefferson wrote. This is not new. It is the old practice of despots, to use a part of the people to keep the rest in order. And those who have once got an ascendancy and possessed themselves of all the resources of the nation, their revenues in office, he's speaking here obviously of John Adams, their revenues in office have immense means for retaining their advantage. But our situation, our present situation, is not a natural one. See, he knew that the natural state of humankind was egalitarian, not this fear-mongering stuff. He said, and his next sentence, but still I repeat it, this is not the natural state. Our nation's wisest political commentator, Thomas Jefferson, said, be this as it may, in every free and deliberating society, there must from the nature of man be opposite parties and violent dissension and discords. And one of these, for the most part, must prevail over the other for a longer or shorter time. Perhaps this party division is necessary to induce each to watch and delegate to the people the proceedings of the other. But, Jefferson asks rhetorically, will the evil stop there? And then he goes on for a few paragraphs about, you know, how bad things are. And this is 1798. And then he writes, a little patience and we shall see the reign of witches pass over, their spells dissolved, and the people recovering their true sight, restoring their government to its true principles. Notice the word principles there. It is true that in the meantime we are suffering deeply in spirit, and incurring the horrors of a war and long oppressions of enormous public debt. If the game runs sometimes against us at home, we must have patience till luck turns, and then we shall have an opportunity of winning back the principles we have lost. He's talking about a nation that has lost its way. For this is the game where principles are the stake. And then he signs it. He says, better luck, therefore, to us all in health, happiness, and friendly salutations for yourself, your friend, T. Jefferson. And then underneath that, he writes, now keep in mind, this is the sitting Vice President of the United States. Under that, he writes, P.S. It is hardly necessary to caution you to let nothing of mine get before the public. A single sentence got hold of by the porcupines will suffice to abuse and persecute me in their papers for months. I just find it amazing. So we have been there. We've been here. You know, we've been through the Revolutionary War. We've been through the Civil War. We've been through World Wars. We've been through Joe McCarthy. We've been through it all. We will make it through this. But we will only make it through this if we don't let go, if we don't give up. We cannot give up. Ray in Boone's Mill, Virginia. Hey, Ray, what's on your mind?
Yes, I was.
You're on the air, Ray.
Yeah, okay. I was going to talk about Pat Robertson. He's been real big in the political scene, especially in Virginia. And he ran for president in 1988, and he's big in our politics right now. Our governor was, you know, put in or supported a lot by Pat Robertson. He also went to Regency University, which was Pat Robertson's university. So
right.
Pat Robertson is a big political force along with religious.
That's very, excellent point. And he's having an influence on this country in ways that, thank you for making that, in ways that are tremendous. And I think that this is what Thomas Jefferson was writing about. You know, that we go through these cycles in this country, and we've been through them before. And what comes out of the bad cycles is the better cycles. America, if you look at the history, we've had some real setbacks. And the Great Depression was a real setback. Reaganomics, a real setback. We've had some real setbacks. But what comes out of those setbacks is the people wake up and they take the country back. And I think that the alternative media that's out there, I think the many alternative voices out there, I think all the Fighting Bob Fest that Bernie Sanders and I and Jim Hightower and I will be at this weekend is all part of taking back America and making it a good and great nation. So don't forget, democracy begins with you. Show up, get active, tag, you're it. I'll see you tomorrow from Madison.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.